part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
Apologies for all the back and forth. It's been kind of a morning, been kind of a couple of weeks, so I apologize.
You're good. It's all good.
Just to let everyone know, listening out there, there may be some distant construction noises on my end. There is some construction going on in the part-time fanboy clubhouse this morning. You should not hear it because my mic is directional. But, you know, in case you hear something in the distance and you're like, what's going on? That's what it is. Caleb, thank you for joining me on this, Saturday morning for you, afternoon. Saturday morning for me, afternoon for you, correct?
No, I'm actually in the same time zone that you are. I'm Pacific time.
Oh, I did not know that. Okay, well, nobody let me know. For some reason, I thought you were East Coast. Okay. Well, then I apologize for making you get up at 9:30 in the morning on a Saturday.
Oh, it's all good. I was already up and at 'em.
Got it. Well, let's just start off by saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I have a very special guest on the line. Your name is Caleb Palmquist. Did I get the pronunciation correct?
Yep, you got it.
And I always like to start off these things whenever anyone has a Kickstarter, fundraiser, Zoop, whatever, by letting people know why you are here right off the bat so that they can throw money your way. Although you have already funded, it looks like. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Your project is called Dragon Grit Number One. Would you like to let the people know what Dragon Grit is? Just give them the elevator pitch, as I always say.
Yeah. So Dragon Grit is a fantasy Western about a world where cowboys ride dragons instead of horses. And the book, the plot itself is about an ex-outlaw named Vera, who takes on a risky escort job, essentially taking a sort of city slicker type across the wilderness, all while being pursued by an old rival of hers and his dangerous gang. So, it's a fantasy dragon rider story, but it's really influenced by stories like 310 to Yuma and True Grit, and Tombstone, but definitely in the vein of those travelogue Western stories.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, I saw some of the preview art, which was shared with me, and the book looks gorgeous. I mean, everything looks fantastic. I love the concept. I mean, I'm actually a big fan of Westerns, like old time Westerns and modern Westerns, just good Westerns. So when I saw this, part of my thought was like, how did nobody ever think of like doing this?
You know, that's always the question that I have. It always seems like the projects that really hit for me are the ones that no one's really done before somehow. My most successful book was called Unicorn Vampire Hunter, which is about a unicorn who kills vampires with his horn. And at that time, everyone was asking me, how did no one think of this? And I was like, I don't know, but I'm glad they didn't.
that's great.
Yep.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's funny because I was looking through your Kickstarter history and you're kind of an old hat at this. It seems like this is like your 19th Kickstarter. Is that correct?
So this is my 19th Kickstarter on this profile, but I've done the first few I did were on another profile. And then I also collaborated with a few people on books that were on other profiles. So I think this is actually my 25th Kickstarter.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, I mean, I was looking through your history and I thought it was really amusing. Like your first Kickstarter is called Help Me Design This Giraffe. And it's basically like you've got the art for a giraffe and it's like letting people design the postcard. I just need to know more about this. Was this just like a like getting your feet wet project and like Kickstarter, like trying it out for the first time, or like what was that all about?
So that I had actually done my first two Kickstarters were on another profile. When I first started doing comics, I was collaborating with a friend of mine. We were writing a comic together, and so the giraffe Kickstarter was my third one, but it was also the first one on this profile. And I did want to have like I wanted to have something small and silly as my first one on this profile, so I could like sort of start to build that audience. And I want to say what actually happened was that Kickstarter had sent out a call to creators to say, okay, we're doing a break Kickstarter, like hashtag, I guess. It was like, it was a thing where they were inviting everyone to make projects that quote unquote broke the rules of Kickstarter. Oh, so, okay. So I was like, well, why don't I just draw a giraffe and then everyone can give me a dollar to add something to the giraffe. And then I will draw all those things on it and put it on a postcard and send it out to everyone. Cause it turned what I found out when I did that, it was just years ago, but 5 years ago, but I realized that I could send a postcard even internationally for like a dollar. So I was like,
oh, great.
So it was like, everyone could participate. I think it only had like less than 100 backers. It had 65 backers, but it was so fun. And I think that while I did a couple other projects that were kind of in the same vein later on, but for the most part, I don't do projects that are that silly. But I like to think that I carry that same energy of like audience participation and like, you know, people being involved in direct communication with backers into every project that I do.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you asked me about that, because it really, I think that that is like the core ethos of who I am as a creator. It's like, you know, let's do something out there that's fun and gets people involved, but also has heart.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, that was kind of like the genius of it and why I wanted to ask you about it. I was like, because I mean, one of the things, you know, I'm an artist part time. I work on my own like little comic. I have been for like years and years and years, and I draw and the whole thing myself. And it's taken me forever, like years and years and years, to just get through it. But one of the things that, like, you know, when I'm chatting with friends or people I've met through this podcast is like, people are always like, oh, why don't you do a Kickstarter? And I'm like, the anxiety of doing a Kickstarter to me, you know, while living my regular life, like, just seems like it would be unmanageable. But like, to help me design this giraffe, I was like, this is genius, because it's almost like, but it sounds like you were doing Kickstarters before this. But to me, it was almost like, hey, let me try this. It's kind of silly, but let me see where this goes and see if it can become kind of successful.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely was a, not something that was ever intended to make me a lot of money. It was just kind of silly and see, you know, what's going to happen. And the stakes were so low that I figured, you know, might as well. And I think that that's also part of the fun of Kickstarter, is that you can kind of do whatever you want. I mean, you know, there's, obviously, if you do something like help me design this giraffe, you're not going to make thousands of dollars. But it kind of is like, I think, shows that on the platform, anything is possible. Because like, unlike, I mean, the thing that I always say that's great about Kickstarter is that you don't have to ask for permission. Like, I think I'm probably my biggest like soapbox thing that I have in indie comics is I am pretty anti-publisher.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I say that as someone who has worked with publishers, and maybe I'm anti-publisher because I had some bad experiences, but also the thing is, I think you go back 20 years ago and you had to find, if you wanted anyone to actually read your stuff outside of like a few people that saw you at a convention or whatever.
Yeah.
You had to get a publisher.
Yeah.
You don't have to do that now. You don't have to do that now. And And because you don't have to do that, you don't have to ask for permission, you can make whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got some crazy idea that Image would never take, do it anyway. And maybe it's the next big thing and, you know, they'll be sad that they missed out. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that gives me the space to do things like help me design this draft, but also, you know, things like Unicorn Vampire Hunter, and Dragon Grit, you know, and maybe some of those projects would have been accepted at publishers, but I mean, I've found a lot of success and I've certainly made more money than I would have made going with even a decently sized publisher.
Sure, sure, sure. No, I mean, that seems to be a lot of the conversations I'm either having on air or off air, like when I meet people like at conventions or even just chatting, you know, on the phone or, you know, kind of like making friendships through this podcast and stuff. And the sort of like publisher pushback, especially I helped create a book called Baby Badass like years ago. And there's sort of like an ongoing lawsuit with the publisher, not just me and my co-creator, but like a lot of other people who had issues with that publisher. And there's just kind of this ongoing thing, which I don't even know I can get into like on air, but just seeing like what people are dealing with small publishers who a lot of creators seem to consider kind of just like IP factories, right? At this point, like, hey, give us your idea. You know, you pay for all the publishing, you run a Kickstarter and we'll distribute it for you. But as part of that, we take a huge chunk of the entertainment rights, which let's face it, that seems to be where a lot of the money is a lot of the big money is pouring in on comics. Any thoughts to that?
Yeah. I mean, what I'll say is you're right. A lot of these publishers are just IP farms. And also, here's what I'll say is that there's this mythos around the idea of the creator owned comic. Mm. Okay. So back in the 90s, we had Image like, and they're saying, oh, we're creator-owned. But also remember at that time, Image was founded sort of like how there are some new companies like Distillery being founded now with like a sort of similar idea where it's like, but it's like all these really famous, really successful, really well-known comic creators going and making their own like thing, right? And they all have a stake in it. And they're all like, you know, of course, like Todd McFarlane, you know, has a stake in Image, right? So like he's profiting off of that. But I think what ended up happening is a lot of these publishers came up after that and they're like, oh, everybody loves the creator owned model because you get to retain, you know, your ownership of your IP and everything. Okay, but the way creator owned works in practical sense is that you don't get an advance, you don't get a page rate.
Yeah.
What you get is a royalty, and there's no guarantee that that company is going to spend money well or market your book well or anything. And so what these little companies are really getting is a free IP and all the art for free. They get a free book that all they have to do is they have to pay to print and distribute it. Easy money for them, but the creators are often not seeing that money. And in fact, if they hadn't run a Kickstarter to fund it, they would be way in the hole. I mean, I have talked to many, many, many creators who have had books published through all sorts of small publishers and larger publishers, where the amount of money that they got doesn't come anywhere close to what they had to spend to make the book. And it only was possible for them because of Kickstarter. So it's like, you know, if I see someone who raised 50 grand on a book and then they get published by a major publisher, which I won't name, and they only end up making $1,500 total over the lifetime of that book being published through Simon & Schuster and Diamond and Lunar.
Yeah.
And royalties. And that's like a success story of the stories that I've heard. Right. Like I'll tell you personally, when I had my publishing deal, which if you're listening, you can Google me and figure it out. It won't be that hard. I made $125.
Really?
Over the course of the. Yes.
Wow.
And that series raised, I'd have to do the math, but probably if I added them all together, all the Kickstarters, like $75,000+. Now, you know, my profit margin is way less than that, but it's a lot more than $125. I'll tell you that.
Sure.
And so it's like the advantage, and you know, the counter argument. Sorry, I'm getting on a soapbox here. I don't know if that's what you wanted.
No, I'm fine with whatever you want to chat with, but I mean, we should get back to your book. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that people find fascinating. And we can talk more about that like later. But I mean,
sure. Yeah.
I mean, that is the sort of fascination with me, and not to take a too deep dive into Kickstarter. But it's like the other question that I come back with sometimes, too, is like I see people on Kickstarter. I see people projects getting funded. And then there's a part of me. It's like, how much money are you taking home after that, right? Because you got to print the books, you got to print the stickers, you got to mail the books, you got to Kickstarter gets a piece. And then that's part of the thing that I also hear is like, yeah, projects are getting funded, but a lot of them are in the red or in the black. You know what I mean? They're not, you know, they still haven't made money at the end of that, even though they have all the books. And then it's like, oh, we have to go schlep at conventions in order to make up for that loss that we didn't, you know, regain. So
would you like a peek behind the curtain how the sausage is made here?
Sure, why not? Let's do it. But I do want to talk about your book, but I love chatting about this stuff.
No, what I'm for this book, Dragon Grit, which I'm funding right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Focusing back on that. I set the goal for $3,500.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to fund, I knew I would fund early. The amount of money that I needed, as you said, to not be in the red was $9,000.
Okay. So you started at around 3,500, and what you needed was 9,000, right?
What I needed to break past the point where I would be profitable, yes.
Okay.
Was $9,000.
Okay.
And there's a lot of reasons for doing that. I'm not trying to be like deceitful or anything like that.
Sure.
It's kind of like, here's my risk margin. Here's what I've already invested this much in the book. And so this book is getting made one way or another. And here's what I'm willing to risk. But it also is an expression of confidence. Like, I know that this book is going to do well. And I know that the energy from funding early is really great for the book. Mm. And so I set the goal at 3,500 based on my projections, based on how many pre-launch followers we had, my email list and all this other stuff. I was, I had some estimates about what I might be able to make. It has actually exceeded my estimates, so that's great. But you're right. A lot of books are losing money, but part of that is just growing and figuring out the platform. Mm-hmm. I'm fortunate enough that most of my books make money on Kickstarter now.
Okay.
Not everyone is in that position, but you know, it's you get to make those decisions for yourself. Because if you're like, if you go into Kickstarter and you're like, this is the amount of money I have to make to break even, and I can't afford to not break even, then set the goal at that amount and just like, and go for it. And if you don't fund, you don't fund. And it's also totally fine to call it quits. My last campaign before this wasn't hitting and I canceled it. And a lot of people told me that was a bad idea, but
oh, really?
Then I had my most successful launch ever right afterward. So
with the same project or a different project?
No, with a different project.
Gotcha.
With a different project that's now kind of been put on the back burner and may resurface later on. But, I mean, you know, like you can launch anything you want on Kickstarter and it's not guaranteed to hit, and trying something new is always a risk. And I've done, you know, 25 campaigns, I'm not immune from failure. I mean, you know, it's a risk. It's a business. It's like you putting yourself out there, and you could invest a lot, not only money, but also time, and you could lose that. My first few projects years ago, I lost a lot of money. I went deep into credit card debt. I crawled out of it, but my first few books that I made, I definitely lost a lot of money on.
Yeah. No, well, thank you for being so honest about it too, because most of the time, I mean, I get honest conversations about Kickstarter crowdfunding and stuff like that. But generally, these sort of conversations happen offline, right? Where it's like, damn, now I got to do this and now I got to do that. So just the thought, and again, that gives me more anxiety about me, myself, to dipping my toe into it, you know, and also I need to have more product. But, you know, that was one of the things while I was looking through your history, right? Like I saw the Help Me Design This Giraffe. And then the next project was A Small Favor, The Undying Soldier, which looks really cool to me, but that did not fund. And then you went to Unicorn Vampire Hunter and that funded. So I guess since we're kind of taking a little bit of a deep dive into this, what did you learn from one project to another for you that you were like, okay, now I'm funded? Did you have to lower your goals or did you just have a better mailing list, more connections? Like what sort of things have you learned going through all these Kickstarters? I mean, I know that's a big, big question, but, you know, maybe distill it a bit, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, some of it's luck. Some of it is just finding the right thing. My book, A Small Favor, was a very like sort of designed by committee book that I thought would like hit the things that would matter to people. And I was also learning how to present stuff on Kickstarter. Wasn't doing the best job. And then I decided to just go with the project that really was something that I cared deeply about. That was a silly thing that I was very passionate about, which was Unicorn Vampire Hunter. And that really hit. And that was also during the pandemic, like fall of 2020, which incidentally was an amazing year for Kickstarter.
Yeah.
It was like a really boom year for Kickstarter. And so I was lucky enough to get some attention with that. And then it just kind of, you know, kind of grew from there. I would say the mailing list is a big thing. I have slowly built up the mailing list, over time. So, you know, back when I was doing A Small Favor, I had maybe a few hundred people on the mailing list, and now I'm at about 2,000, which is small, I think, even compared to some other people, but I think, you know, the people who join my mailing list are people who are very interested in what I'm doing. So I have a high open rate and high participation rate. If you're talking about learning from failure, I have never been a fan of just like, okay, in a month, I'm going to relaunch this same project and hardly anything is going to be changed, but I'm going to lower the funding goal. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really jive with me. I'm not against relaunching things or reimagining things. But if you look a little bit later on my Kickstarter history, I ended up launching a book called Vampire Detective in Space. And if your keen-eyed viewers might realize that Vampire Detective in Space actually has a lot in common with A Small Favor. The two main characters are almost exactly the same. They have the same names. The biggest difference is that the main character went from being like a sort of immortal, a mysterious immortal, into being a vampire. And the plot is different. The plot of A Small Favor was like this big epic thing that I was like, after 10 volumes, people will finally understand what this is about, which is silly. Uh-huh. But Vampire Detective in Space is a smaller, more intimate story. But I really repurposed a lot of the ideas. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that if a project fails, you like completely reimagine it. But for me, it was like I did care about a lot of the things that were in that book, but it wasn't working. So I was like, late after a couple of years, I was like, how can I take some of those ideas and put them into something new? And that's kind of a similar process that I'm going through with my last campaign that failed, which is called The Tiger Who Would Be King, I ended up canceling. Because it just wasn't going to make the kind of money that I needed it to make. And I may beautiful. Come back.
It looks it like does. A beautiful and, book.
Yeah. Dave Swartz is awesome. He's very talented. And he worked with me on Vampire Detective in Space. And I think the book would have been really cool. And we will come back to it. But it's just going to be a little bit reimagined. To me, I just knew that if I waited just a little bit of time and relaunched it with a lower goal or whatever, I wasn't going to be capturing anyone different. Mm-hmm. So we have a new idea for it. It's just going to take a little bit of time to do. And Yeah. So, I mean, if you're asking, you know, the lessons that I've learned is that, you know, failure can happen no matter who you are. I mean, even if you look at famous movie directors, you know, someone who, I mean, I think for a while we all thought M. Night Shyamalan was like, couldn't fail. And then he made Avatar: The Last Airbender, right?
Yeah. Maybe even before that. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, go on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, So I guess it would be like, you know, be open to the idea that you can fail and that you can learn from that, and don't just beat your head against the wall. And it, my personal opinion is just relaunching the same project almost exactly the same way is a fool's errand. Mm-hmm. And that you really got to take a deep dive and look like what wasn't working here, because you're right. Tiger Who Would Be King is beautiful. I think it's like, I think it's a cool concept, and, but I had to really investigate and be like, what wasn't working here? And what could I do differently? Like, what about this wasn't connecting with my audience? Because you look at that one, you know, my launch was pretty weak. Like my launch for Dragon Grit, I had like double the number of backers on the first day, and I'm advertising to the same people. So I'm like, what about this new one is hitting that wasn't, and how can I kind of think about that and think how I'm going to move forward with the new project? Based on what's working.
Sure.
So, sure. Yeah.
No, it's interesting because I'm thinking your audience is very much like tied into what you like, because when I was going through your projects, I was like, oh, this guy likes fantasy, or he likes fantasy characters. There's unicorns, there's vampires, this is dragons. Do you want to talk to me a little bit about your history or love of fantasy characters? Like, were you like a D&D nerd, J.R. Tolkien? What was your thing growing up? I mean, like, because there's an obvious, you know, like, thing that you like. Like, I like superheroes. I was raised on superheroes. And even though people, like, these days are like, oh, superheroes suck, the industry is, you know, swimming with superheroes, I'm like, great, I fucking like that. Like, that's what I was raised on. You know, that doesn't mean I like everything that has superheroes in it, right? But, you know, I read detective stuff, I read fantasy stuff, but that's the thing that when I was a little kid, I was like, male power fantasy, thank you. Like, you know what I mean? So what is it about fantasy characters, vampires, unicorns, dragons, like that sort of thing that floats your boat?
Well, I've always liked fantasy stuff. I also read a lot of superhero comics when I was a kid. I mean, when I was a kid, I had like random comics that I would pick up at the mall. They used to have those like stores where there'd be a little grab bag, you know, where you get like a mystery bag of like three comics. So it'd be like, oh, this is like New Mutants and Ultimate X-Men and whatever, just like mixed in together.
Yeah, those were the greatest and the worst at the same time, because you were like, oh, these three books are great, but these two are shit. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. And so I had like when I was a kid, I had like random issues of X-Men that I just read a million times, you know?
Sure.
And I always liked X-Men and Spider-Man, but I also was... I always had like a real fascination with unicorns when I was a kid. And I had this unicorn poster that I still have on my wall that I got when I was like 6 years old. And it's like, just like a painting of a unicorn. And I don't know. I always really liked unicorns, which, you know, we could, if this was a therapy session, I could get into what that meant for my relationships with other children at school. Anyway, I always wanted to tell a story involving unicorns. And then, you know, I always really liked fantasy books, but I will say that, this Dragon Grit I co-wrote with my wife, Lorelei Jonasson, who's a novelist, and, this is our first project working together, and she is a huge dragon fan and a dragon writer fan. And so, you know, I had read books like Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern. I was a big fan of as a kid and things like that. But I mean, she took it to another level in terms of kind of what she was interested in with fantasy and dragons in particular.
How does that work? Like a fascination with like, like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't like, is there lore? Are there like clubs? Like what sort of like, what is like a real, not obsession with dragons, but like love for that sort of fantasy? How does that look? Like, how does that manifest? I mean, besides books and stuff like that.
I mean, there's just like a lot of books and movies that are about dragons, you know? I mean, like I'm 33 and my wife is 33. And so we were kind of the perfect age for the Aragorn series. Did you ever read that?
No, I had not read it. No.
It was a book by like this, at the time, like a prodigy author who was like a teenager when he was writing these books. And honestly, if you go back and read them now, you can tell. But it was a very popular series, got made into a movie that was terrible that nobody really liked. And then like I said, like Dragon Riders of Pern was a big one. And then, you know, like my wife being into dragons, she wrote, she did write a dragon book that was never published. She has a manuscript that she keeps talking about returning to, but now that we've done Dragon Grit, I think that's sort of filling her cup on that one. And you know, just like, she's got a lot of little dragon, figurines and action figures and stuff around the house.
Okay. That's kind of like what I was getting at. Absolutely.
So it's,
see my home office. Yeah. It's really bad. The obsession is like really bad with the superhero and characters like that. No, that's great. I mean, that's when was the sort of like chocolate and peanut butter moment where you were like, hey, wait a minute, who's the Western fan? Are you the Western fan? Is she the Western fan?
I'm definitely the Western fan. I've sort of gotten her to watch a few classics, you know, that I enjoy.
Okay, what's your favorite? Because this always sets the bar for me. Like, I'm always wondering, like, you know, whenever you meet another Western fan, it's like, okay, are you like a Magnificent Seven? Or are you the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? Or are you Once Upon a Time in the West? Like, how does it work for you? Which one?
I mean, I think that all those that you just said, I'm a fan of, but I would say that the Tombstone. Tombstone is my favorite, and one of the characters in Dragon Grit, actually the villain of the piece, is really inspired by Johnny Ringo. That's my favorite, but I also am a big fan of 310 to Yuma. Which both versions, actually.
I was just gonna ask which one, the original or the remake, right?
I like both versions. I mean, the remake is like, you know, off the wall, ridiculous. I in my opinion, I think it's like just like a crazy action movie.
Yeah. I watched it for the first time like a year or two ago. I had never seen the remake. So anyway, go on. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I like it. I mean, I don't think it's a movie that people really talk about, but.
Yeah, no, they don't. I was surprised when I watched it. I was like, oh, this is actually decent. Like, I thought it was going to suck for some reason and just. Happen to watch it.
I mean, it's a remake, you know, you say about like a remake, especially one that's like sort of floundering and people haven't really heard about.
Yeah.
You know, they usually are bad, but I like 310 to Yuma. I like the concept of the story. And of course, it should not surprise you that I also like the movie True Grit.
Sure.
Which is, you know, obviously kind of the homage in our title of our book.
Yeah.
And our book is a travelogue story, which is True Grit and 310 to Yuma really are travelogue stories. And so that's, I think, within Westerns, the subgenre of travelogue Western stories, where it's like we're going on a journey across the West.
Yeah.
I've always really liked it. And then growing up, my grandma had in her house, had two collections. She still has these. Fortunately, my grandma's still with us, but she still has these two collections. The two authors she loved the most were Agatha Christie and Louis L'Amour.
Oh.
And so I read a bunch of Louis L'Amour books, and like, and you know, if you read enough of Agatha Christie or Louis L'Amour, like they have, they were so prolific, right? Both of these authors wrote so many books, and a lot of them end up kind of, they're a little formulaic, you know, it's like, oh, Agatha Christie, like Hercule Poirot just happens to be there when someone is murdered and he has to interview everyone.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, a lot of Louis L'Amour books are like, oh, this cowboy is being hunted across the desert. And maybe he has someone who's with him, who he's protecting, or maybe he's on his own. I always really like that kind of story. And this isn't quite that. It's a little bit more of like an escort mission, city slicker being drugged through the desert by a seasoned cowboy kind of thing. I would say my love of Westerns comes from both movies and books. Someone recently asked me if I had read like a lot of Western comics, and actually the answer to that is no.
Yeah.
I should read more of them, but they're just not that, I think they're not that prevalent of a genre within comics.
Yeah. And it's hard to come across good ones. I think, you know, what's a good, it's my superhero fan thing is, the Lone Ranger. They did, I think Dynamite did like a Lone Ranger series like a while ago, which actually I was very surprised by. Like, I did not expect to like it. And I think I picked up like an omnibus, like an old omnibus somewhere. I was like, yeah, I've always been curious about this. And I've always liked the mythology of that, like the idea of that character. Particularly, everyone's going to hate me for this, and you may as well, you may too. There was a Lone Ranger movie in the 80s where it's like, it's not a good movie, but it's like the first half is good. And then once he becomes a Lone Ranger, it's like it becomes garbage. It's just like the whole build up to him becoming a Lone Ranger is like really, it's like, oh, this is a good Western. And then he becomes a Lone Ranger and you're like, ah, you fucked it up. Like, what did you do? It's just become slow and pondering. And I'm just like, you had this really good build up. And so, but yeah, if I would recommend that Western series, that's definitely a favorite of mine. Have you seen the Amazon? I think it's on Amazon, which we canceled our Amazon Plus because they started adding commercials to it. But The English, the Emily Blunt thing, have you seen that yet?
No.
Oh, it's called The English. It's so good. It's a Western. I don't know if you'll like it as much as I did, but I was fucking blown away by it. I was like, holy shit. Like, it's just, it's really good. I think you'll like it. I don't know. Maybe you won't. But she's
cool.
Yeah, she's an amazing actress. And it's just like my whole family was just, we were just watching it and just like, this is great. I'm very curious about like you getting into Westerns. I mean, it sounds like you had books in the house and family members that exposed you to, because I know that for me growing up, I was never into Westerns, like, because it was a lot of that John Wayne stuff or stuff that would come on the TV and I'd be like, ah, this is boring. Like, it just never clicked with me. And it wasn't until like one day somebody was like, rent The Magnificent Seven. And I was like, okay, like Yul Brynner, like really? Like, I was just, and I love you. I love The King and I love all that shit. Like Westworld, like that's great. But I was just like, really, dude in a black hat? And I watched it. And these were, you know, I'm very much older than you. I'm older than you. And these were the days of VHS, boys and girls, you know, where you had a cassette and you had to stick it in the machine and watching it on a square TV that wasn't as big as your wall, but like just being blown away by it. Like just, so I just like not expecting anything and just being like, holy shit. Like, this is actually a good story. Like, what was, were, did you have a bias against Westerns at all growing up? Or was it something that you were very open to once you were kind of like exposed to it? Cause I did have a bias against it. It took me a long time to find the good stuff as it was.
I don't know that I had a bias, but I think in high school is when I first watched Tombstone and I think that's why that's still my favorite Western movie, because it just like really, that movie blew me away. I mean, I still to this day like quote that movie in my head all the time, you know. I think I didn't never had a bias, but I certainly was like, wasn't like massively interested in it until I saw that movie. I had read some books and I had seen a few Western movies, but Tombstone was the one that was like, wow, this is a genre that I really like.
Yeah. It's interesting because the filmmaking in that is like very modern and, you know, the editing and the acting and everything like that. And it's funny because like, to me, it was like Westerns just seemed like very dry and slow. You know what I mean? When I was a kid and I was just like, yeah, this just seems like something that like, you know, my parents or, you know, I'm just not into it. And it took a long time for me to be like, to just, like I said, discover the good stuff and be like, so that's great that you were kind of like exposed in high school, like right off the bat. And now, you know, it's inspired you to make like, you know, a mishmash of like dragons and a Western. But that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. Is your world like, is it the United States frontier? Is it like an alternate reality USA, or is it like an alien world? Like, what is the environment like? Like, what does it spring from?
So it's definitely not an alternate reality US. It's a fantasy world. There's a lot of things that are different about this world. This is definitely like inspired by the historical West, but it's definitely different. It's something that is going to be explored a little bit in the comic, but essentially it's kind of like a continent that gets settled and is only inhabited by dragons, and so we went back and forth a lot on like, because if you're writing a Western, you're going to come up against the problem of Native American tribes.
Yep. Right? I was just going to try and ask about that, but anyway, go on.
Yeah. And how do you deal with that? Because I think some fan, like if you look at like the video game series Dragon Age, like the way that they handled it is like, oh, the elves are the Native Americans.
Oh.
And that is something that's been highly critiqued.
Okay.
And I don't necessarily have strong opinions or an interest in delving into whether or not Dragon Age is like problematic or not. I don't know. That's like not for me to say, but I also was like, okay, I don't want to like fall into a trap where people are, you know, potentially taking issue with how I'm representing things. And so
sure,
rather than having Native Americans in our story that are being exploited or whatever, instead it's fantasy world, the cast is very diverse, and we have the West is very much the domain of dragons, and you'll see as the story goes on sort of why it's dangerous to be out in the West, because there are wild dragons, and there's a big difference. We have a big thing in our story about the difference between domestic dragons and wild dragons, which is similar to the difference between wolves and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, some people ride wild dragons. The main character Vera rides a wild dragon named Blaze, who she has a bond with, but wild dragons can be unpredictable, and they can be all sizes. They can be, you know, scary and hard to deal with. And if you're encroaching on a dragon's territory, for example, if you set up a mining town and you're trying to mine gold, and it turns out there is a treasure dragon down in the mine that you're trying to mine from, it might not work out so well for you.
What a great idea. That is amazing. That's a great like way to look at sort of, you know, like the gold rush or anything like that. That's right. Fantastic. So, I mean, that's one of the things that, I mean, again, like expansionism is a part of it, like the Western. And it's kind of like one of those things that all our movies and pop culture, like particularly 50s, 60s, like we kind of like all ignored that. It was always like, you know, and then when we did, it was like kind of insensitive. And that's kind of like why I was asking, is this like an alternate, you know, kind of like US? Because I mean, expansionism feeds into that myth of the cowboy, right? How do you deal with that if there are not like Native Americans or that sort of like, you know, go West young man or woman, as the case may be in this story, sort of like that, that expansionism desire to like, you know, go conquer land, get your own piece of, you know, quote, the American dream. Is that something that exists in your book?
Yeah, that definitely exists in the book.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It's just that the the thing that you're doing when you go west and you're trying to take your peace is you're like settling where there are wild dragons.
Okay.
And kind of what does that end up meaning? And we, you know, there's always the danger too. I mean, you can't please everybody. There's always the danger of basically like, that it's erasure by, you know, by saying, well, there's no Native American.
Understood. Yeah. Yeah.
It is a fictional fantasy world, and there is a concept of colonialism and expansionism and manifest destiny. But the people, as it were, that are there before the humans come in and settle are these dragons, and whether or not they can get along peacefully with the dragons is something that we do explore in the story. Cool. And you know, I don't know, maybe I'm a coward for not having natives.
Well, it's
the book, but yeah, it was something we went back and forth on a lot.
Sure.
And I didn't think that there was a good way to include like Native American stand-ins without making the book all about that.
Sure.
And that's not what the book is about.
Yeah. Or offending people, I would imagine. Just right. Like outright just saying like you said, elves, like as native, like that's just, yeah, that's weak sauce.
Yeah, I don't want to have like a stand-in where it's like, oh, the elves or the trolls or whatever, those are the Americans. Because then it's like, then I'm like, there's like racial stereotypes at play there. And the fact is that what this story is about the relationships between the characters and the like people trying to make a scrap out a living. Hopefully one way that I believe most of my books are very diverse, and I think this book is no exception. The main character is a white woman, but then the other main characters are a young black man and a Hispanic man. I'd like to think that, you know, I'm there's some diversity there, but also we're able to really focus in on the core themes of the story.
Sure. Understood. Are the dragons like sentient? Do they talk? Like, is that part of your mythology in there? Or like,
so the dragons do not talk. And that's another thing that we went back and forth on a lot. So like in a lot of dragon rider stories, fantasy stories, it's like, oh, the dragons can communicate telepathically or whatever, and they have like a soul bond with their rider, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
We decided not to do that. Dragons are like horses, but they're like maybe smarter than horses,
like dolphin horses.
Yeah, maybe. Like they are.
That's my book. Dolphin.
They're smart enough to recognize loyalty.
Yeah,
and they care about the people that they've made connections with.
Yeah,
and they're cunning, but they're not human level intelligent. And that was important because really what we're writing is a Western, and if you had a Western, like something like True Grit or Tombstone, and the horses were like as smart as the people, that's a different story.
Yeah. That's a whole other ball game there. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like a big thing is we have three pairs of characters, like each of the main characters has a dragon, and the bonds between the character and the dragon are a big deal, but it's very much like the bond between a man and his horse or a man and his dog. The dragons don't talk, but they are, you know, they're like particularly smart horses.
gotcha. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about as a married man myself, it seems like you've been working in comics, like on Kickstarter and stuff like that, but you said your wife was a novelist. Was she interested in comics? Like, what was it like sort of getting her to, or working with her, coming to her with the idea of like, hey, let's make a comic together. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're a novelist, but there's this whole other medium that I've been exploring for, it sounds like you said, 5 years. How did you come to work together, like, on this particular project?
Well, something we bonded over early on when we started dating is that we were both writers and
sure.
And we both like fantasy stuff. And this actually was originally envisioned as a novel.
Okay.
We wanted to write something together, and I really like Western. She really likes dragons. And so we actually wrote about half of it as a novel, and we wrote out the whole plot, and we wrote about half as a novel. And then we were really starting to think about the cool visual element of this, like cowboys riding dragons.
Yeah.
And
it is very
and
cool.
So, and, you know, also not going to lie, I do, like you said, I have a lot of experience at this point with comics. I kind of know how to build a comic and how to market it a little bit. And so it felt like an obvious thing to do, to make it into a comic book. And you know, just for the visual element, I think is really cool. Someday, you know, we may write a novel together, but I think given the response to this and how people have been very enthusiastic about it, I think that, you know, it's, and she did not grow up reading comics, not really.
Yeah.
And she'd read like some, she had some webtoons that she liked. And so it's very new medium for her, but, you know, she was interested. And since she has started to read some more comics and got an idea for what she likes. And so, you know, I think she was a little hesitant at first. But I think now she's very happy that we made it as a comic, and you know, our process is, sometimes she will write out scripts, but a lot of times what we fall into as our process is that we brainstorm together and we kind of outline things, and then she writes it. She just like describes the scenes. It almost writes it like a novel, like the issues, and then and then I take it and I turn them into scripts.
Got it.
And so it's like a very back and forth process between us, which has been pretty productive and good.
No, that's cool. That's cool. Was it difficult for you to be like, hey, come here, comics? Like, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, there are a lot of us who, you know, I mean, me being a spouse, like my spouse is not into that at all. Like she's not. She's just never been in. She's like, she appreciates it and thinks like it's great and stuff like that. But were you, and then, you know, sometimes there's people who are like, you know, I write novels or I write screenplays. I'm not interested in that. Like you go, was it a thing of like, hey, look it, we could do this. Like, you know, how much convincing did she need?
Not a lot. So what I'll say, I am very fortunate because I am married to a huge nerd. comics has never really been her thing, but like one of our biggest things that we do together is we play card games and board games.
Oh, nice.
Like very into those things.
Sure.
And I always get surprised because I think like probably just like, you know, growing up in our culture, I was very conditioned to the idea that like when I got married or had a girlfriend or whatever, like it would be pulling teeth to get her to do any nerdy stuff with me, right?
Yeah.
And every time we play a new board game or a card game, it's like I'll be excited about it, and then she'll sit down to play and she'll be like way more into it than I am. which is awesome.
And so
you know, she still doesn't like all the same things I do. Like, for example, like I'm really into Star Wars. I mean, you know, as any
still?
Sort of red-blooded American male.
Still? Okay. Still. Okay.
I guess.
I'll shut up now. Continue.
Controversial opinion.
Continue. Yeah, no, yeah. Mine is probably the controversial opinion, if you want
well,
to be honest.
Well, you're far from the only person. I think that I'm uniquely situated to be still a Star Wars fanboy because I was like literally the same age as Anakin when episode one came out. But
now I'm old. You're definitely making me feel old. Anyway, go on. My wife fell asleep during The Phantom Menace. I was like, ooh, this is bad. Like, yeah. Anyway, continue. Sorry, go on. I figured I would share that since we're...
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
My wife will watch Star Wars with me, but only the animated stuff.
Oh, okay. Right? Gotcha.
Okay. She liked the Clone Wars. She likes the Bad Batch. We watched that together. But Rebels? Then, like, oh, Ahsoka. Rebels.
I liked Rebels a lot. Yeah.
But then it's like, you know, like Ahsoka or Andor or whatever. She's like, you can watch that by yourself. And that's fine.
Understood. Yeah.
And so that's kind of like how we engage in nerdy stuff together. She's got stuff that she really likes that I sort of will sort of engage with sometimes. And then I've got stuff that's just going too far for her. Like, you know, I got like both old and new, like Star Wars Expanded Universe stuff that, you know, I got a bookshelf of books that I,
sure.
And she's like, you can read those, you know? And then comics were kind of the same way. Is like, definitely I've gotten her more into comics, like as we've been together, but there are certain things she engages with that she likes. And then other things that she's like, you know, it's not like a huge level of interest for her. But it's definitely not like, oh, I'm not interested in that. And I don't want to touch it. You know, it's just kind of, I think if anything, my wife has a more healthy relationship with fandom than I do, where it's like, I'll pick and choose the things that I like. Whereas I'm like, even if it feels like self-flagellation, I'll watch every Marvel thing that comes out, even the bad ones, you know,
because yeah,
I'm just sort of a slavish same. Fanboy.
Yeah, I remember watching Secret Invasion and my daughter coming, and she's like, you're watching this? And I'm like, I just leave me alone. Like, it's the 90s, like, the, like, you know, like we've come to the point where we realize, like, this is no longer as good as it once was. Like, you know what I mean? And it's just like, but I just, you know, I'm just like sitting there just like, wait, it's like, just waiting for it to like be good again. Like, please come back to me. Like, yeah. And I totally get what you're saying. Like, yeah, I will take you one further where it's like, I've become sort of like a collector of like statues and figurines and stuff like that. Like not figures, but like statues, and I'm always on the lookout for like bargains and stuff. And it can even be like a character, like my example is like, I don't like the Punisher. Like, it's not a character that I ever liked, that I ever thought was like super cool. I mean, he's fine, you know, whatever, but I happen to see a statue in a store and I was like, that sculpt is like great. It just looks great. Mm-hmm. And so then I just went on the hunt online and found it for a good price, but I don't care about the Punisher. Like, he sucks as far as I'm concerned, but I just liked the sculpt. Like, I was like, that's cool. So I totally, I know where you're coming from as far as like, just diving into things and willy nilly, but you know, in any case, but it sounds like you guys are working well through this new project together. So that's great. Yeah. And I should also say that my wife is an amazing trooper. Like, she watches zombie movies with me. She goes to see sci-fi with me. And she gets into it, you know what I mean? But she's just not a comic book thing like that. So I'm putting that out.
Totally understandable.
But great. So Dragon Grit number one, currently on Kickstarter. Where can people find you online, Caleb? Do you have like a special hub? Are you still on the awful Twix? Do you have a website? Like, what are we looking at?
So I do have social medias, but I often forget that they exist. So yes, I wouldn't necessarily recommend following me there.
Yeah.
What I would, if you go to CalebQuist.com, there you will be able to sign up for my newsletter, which is the number one best way to keep track of what I'm doing.
Got it.
And then if you're interested in this comic, you can go to DragonGrit.com. Which will take you directly to the Kickstarter. And when the Kickstarter is over, that will redirect to my website. So you'll be able to use that URL to follow along whenever you're listening to this or whenever you encounter it. Those are kind of the places to go. My newsletter is great. I'm upfront about the fact I send out an email every week, but I'm always updating people about what's coming, and people who are on my newsletter get free stuff when they back my comics. So if you're on the newsletter and then you back a comic, and you sort of participate in the newsletter, I give you free exclusive stickers and trading cards and things like that.
Oh, nice. Very cool. Very cool. So it's Caleb Quist, not Caleb Palmquist, right? CalebQuist.com, right?
Caleb Quist. Yeah.
Caleb Quist. Okay. Not the full name.
Not the full name. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, everyone else in my family, my parents and my older brother, all snagged the Gmail addresses, like their first name, quist@gmail.com.
Oh, got it. Got it.
And then I did that. And then it just sort of became a thing. That's how I signed my, the comics when I signed them. So I signed them Sequist.
Oh, so if I get a comic signed Caleb Palmquist, like that's like golden, right?
Well, if you get a comic that's it's signed a rare Caleb occurrence. Palmquist, it's probably not, it probably wasn't me. I sign them. I wanted to develop a signature that was unique, and I really like comic book writer or creator signatures that are legible. Uh-huh. So like Matt Fraction just signs it like Fraction with an exclamation mark at the end.
Gotcha.
And then like there's a few others, like Chip Zdarsky is similar, and Sam Humphries is similar. They have like just very legible, like shortened versions of their names. And so I went with Sequist, and then gotcha. I put a little numbers, you know, the year. So it could be like Sequist 24. And,
wow. Nice.
This is how I like to do it. Cause also when if I sign like a legal document, I'm just scribbling, you know?
Gotcha. Yeah. No, whenever I sign stuff, it's just Horn, Horn. I don't do the first name anymore. Cause it's just like too long. But if I do ever get you to, if we ever do meet in person, and if I do ever get you to sign something for me, I'm going to have you do the full name.
Okay.
just right. because Sounds of good. Me, just because I want to. Well, anyway, Caleb Palmquist, the full name. Thank you so much for joining me on the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And sorry about all the scheduling and back and forth. It's just been a crazy, we had the California rains here. They did a little damage to our home and we're having construction and I'm just running back and forth. And so I really appreciate you dealing with like schedule back and forth craziness. It is called Part-Time Fanboy after all.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So Caleb Palmquist, Dragon Grit number one, now on Kickstarter. Go jump in, throw it some, what do we call them? Gold coins, you know, from Dungeons and Dragons, gold pieces, silver pieces, whatever you got. Please go fund this project. It looks great. All of your stuff looks really great, Caleb, I should say. Like just scrolling through all your past. I don't know how I never came across any of this stuff. So I'm going to go and try and support Dragon Grit number one on Kickstarter. Go now. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. You can check us out on parttimefanboy.com. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. We are still on Facebook. We are still on Instagram. We are no longer on the hellscape that is Twix. Thank you for listening. Go support Dragon Grit number one, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
I'm doing part-time.